Bienvenidos a una nueva edición del podcast Primer Click de Diario Financiero. Lo que debes saber antes de que abra el mercado. Un espacio presentado por EY, construyendo un mejor mundo de negocios.
Muy buenos días, soy Marcela Vélez y desde Londres comento con ustedes las noticias que deben saber para comenzar el día. Bienvenidos a Primer Click de Diario Financiero. Bienvenidos a un episodio especial de Primer Click. Esta es la conversación completa que tuve con Oliver Collin, él es co-head de European Equities de Invesco. Entrevisté a Oliver para nuestro especial semanal de Primer Click y en nuestro episodio regular compartí con ustedes algunas de las principales ideas de Oliver traducidas al español, pero como algunos de ustedes me han pedido en ocasiones anteriores que comparta la conversación original en inglés, pues aquí está. Si prefieren escucharlo en español, busquen en cualquiera sea la plataforma que estén escuchando este podcast nuestro especial. El título es Acciones Europeas. Y también voy a colocar en las notas de este podcast el link a la transcripción de esta entrevista en español. Conversé con Oliver en respuesta al buen momento que estamos viendo en las acciones europeas. Ya pasada la temporada de resultados de las principales empresas en Estados Unidos, la agenda se concentró en Europa y la verdad es que las grandes empresas de esta región no han defraudado con sus reportes. Y esto impulsó a las acciones europeas a un nivel récord. Oliver cubre acciones europeas hace ya una década, tiene un foco especial en empresas small y mid-cap, y muy interesante también es su visión sobre temas como cuál va a ser el impacto de la elección estadounidense en la política fiscal de Estados Unidos. También una mirada diferente sobre el rol que juegan las acciones europeas en los portafolios de inversión. No les adelanto más, aquí comparto con ustedes mi conversación con Oliver Collin de Invesco.
This momentum that we are seeing in European equities has to do only with the earning reports we have seen, or there's a change in the forecast or in the perspective?
Everyone becomes obsessed with index levels and performance and granolas and fangs and everything else. But the truth is that equities are priced based on the economic backdrop that they're operating in. And ultimately, it's that change in the economic backdrop, whether it's better than people were expecting or worse than people were expecting, that is going to drive performance of shares. Now, we're going through reporting season. I'm very happy to talk about the anecdotes within that because they're good. They're positive, as you say. But why are they good? Why are they positive? It's a function of the underlying GDP in Europe. GDP in Europe has been negative, slightly negative, technical recession for two quarters. And the expectation that those European earnings and European companies are being priced off for this year is for 0.6% GDP growth. So below trend. We know European trend growth is lower than, say, the US or an emerging market, but it's 1% to 2%. Let's call it 1.5%. So the expectation for this year is another bad year, 0.6%. Then we have first quarter GDP data for Europe that comes out at annualizing at 1.3%. So more than double the underlying growth rate. That's a great backdrop versus expectations, and therefore for the underlying equities within the region. And lo and behold, then you have a first quarter earnings reporting season and two things. One is the data coming out at reporting is ahead of expectations. That's good. But often that's a function of people cutting numbers, analysts cutting numbers into an earnings season, and then lo and behold, they beat them. They're being massaged down by the IRs of those companies and they come in slightly better. But what's interesting about this reporting season, and it's really unusual, is the, and Citi, by the way, have done the work on this to show that the 4 or 5 weeks into reporting season, we've had upgrades and the companies are beating those expectations. Mm-hmm. And that only happens around about 20% of reporting seasons. So that's a really positive change to the backdrop and for the outlook for European equities in terms of the absolute returns one can expect to make from them. And the correlations between that upgrade cycle before being met by results and leading to a good outcome for European equities is incredibly high. And it means that they typically outperform on a 3 to 6 month following basis versus the world index. So I think we're in that backdrop, but let's not lose sight of where it's coming from. It's coming from the fact that European GDP is better than the underlying expectations. So maybe we want to get into why that is.
Yeah, but even though most of the big companies, I mean, they get most of the revenues from outside Europe. I mean, you except for the banks, okay, but you have big companies like Novo Nordisk, I don't know, the automakers, the luxuries.
It's a great point, but again, it's marginal change. Let's assume that hasn't altered. So let's keep it simple. 50%, and these aren't perfect numbers, but 50% of your earnings come from your domestic economy as a European business, and 50% come from the rest of the world. Well, the delta that means that the GDP numbers are better in Europe is affecting the 50% domestic exposure. And that in itself is driving the positive surprise. It's not the rest of the world that's driving that. And that's the key thing that if there's one takeaway that people remember from listening to this, it's the expectations being wrong that drives share price performance. And that can be negative performance if expectations are too high and positive performance if expectations are too low. And it's a really important point. You also need to overlay what the valuations of the underlying equities are, of course. But it's that part that I think is so critical.
But in that sense, if as you say, and I agree, expectations are key. What happened after this earnings season for the rest of the year? You have many companies upgrading their guidance for the rest of the year, and now we have this expectation of rate cuts in Europe that will help to economic growth. So you will say it will be more difficult for these companies to beat expectations in the coming quarters.
I don't agree with that. I think that the pessimism had got too loud, which meant that the earnings expectations were too low. Those earnings expectations are being raised, but they're not being raised to extortionate levels, and nor, frankly, should they be. There are still a lot of challenges. You mentioned the global economy and that these companies are exposed to. There's US elections. There's Chinese policy that's still uncertain in terms of what the reaction function will be there. So it's not to say that this is going to be amazing. It's that these shares aren't being priced for good. And it therefore, if they're being priced for bad and things are actually good or less bad, then there's upside potential in those equities. Mm-hmm. And I would say that there are certain other parts of the world, and I don't spend my time looking at those in huge detail, but where expectations are high and valuations are high. So there's unsynchronized upside versus downside risk potential. There's more downside potential in those equities than upside.
And could you agree that one difference, I don't know if this is just a perception, that for what I've seen, I have the idea that this better than expected is broader than in other markets. I mean, you see not only tech companies, for example, but you have banks and you have pharmaceuticals, okay, automakers not that good, but you have industrials. So you would say this a kind of broader recovery?
The answer to it is yes, I agree with that. There is Europe has a broad spectrum to its detriment. When there's a concentration in the marketplace that we've had, and if you don't have the exposures to those, so you don't have that technology or that media exposure, those data centers, exposure in Europe, then that's a drag versus the performance that we've seen over the last 12, 18 months from the Magnificent Seven, so-called. So I agree with you on that regard. I do think there's another part to this, though, which is European GDP. I said it was in recession for the second half of last year, but it's a very desynchronized economy, meaning that the consumer has been incredibly strong, but the industrial side of Europe has been incredibly weak. That hasn't been the case in the US. You've had a much more synchronized GDP. So what's happening now in Europe is that because the lack of synchronization, the industrial pressure in Europe was a function of Ukraine war and the power shortages. And if you think about the power shortages directly impacting industrial production, but it also obviously had a massive impact in terms of the raw materials, so the energy complex, the hydrocarbons, and that meant that the chemical industry was effectively killed off on a competitive basis. We went from an okay point in certain regard on the cost curve to the highest point on the cost curve, at the same point that the Chinese demand was rebating, so there was exporting. So a horrible combination of events. As that energy complex normalizes, so the power prices start to come down, that's a tailwind to industrial production. But you've also got the chemical side of the economy starting to become functioning again as from a global perspective. You've got a huge amount of destocking that's taken place for all of the above reasons. And so you get to see a restocking cycle. And that means that there are pockets of the industrial complex and the materials complex in Europe that are really interesting and compelling and at very low prices.
But taking the point about industrial production, we saw yesterday it was reported a contraction, I think, in Spain and Germany for April. So the recovery is not that strong.
No, but it's coming from it's not to say it's not great, but it's coming from less bad.
It's less bad than expected.
And that's the point. And the equities are priced in the bad scenario, because we have to accept that we're near trough in terms of the underlying industrial production in Europe. We've had a big industrial recession in Germany.
Yes.
And yet the prices you're paying for the businesses exposed to that are low. So low prices or low multiples on low earnings, that's a great way to make money. What you should typically see with a cyclical is when they've got high earnings, then the multiple comes down. And when they've got low earnings, the multiple goes up. You ironically pay high prices for those types of companies because that's when the earnings are depressed. But at the moment, what we're seeing is the opportunity to pay low prices for low earnings. And that is typically a great way of making future returns. And it's those opportunities, to your point about the broadening out and the opportunity set in Europe, that are so compelling, in our opinion.
Do you think that this broadness make it more difficult to sell to international investors than, for example, you know, these groups, you mentioned the labels, the Magnificent Seven in the US or the FANGs? I mean, it's easy to sell as a package or a marketing strategy. The European equities, I would say, seeing it from an international perspective, they are not the first option you think of.
Right. It's a really good point. So if I tell you the Novo Nordisk investment case, the Novo Nordisk investment case is that they've got a drug that solves obesity. Mm-hmm. And we know globally, developed markets particularly, but globally as well, that there's a problem with obesity and that obesity leads to other medical conditions, which creates a huge fiscal burden for the economies. It's a really easy investment case, right? I've just told you the investment case, and they've got a duopoly, monopoly stroke duopoly in terms of production of that. So why wouldn't you own that company? You then go into an industrial business, and you've just talked about the German GDP and the industrial production numbers for Europe, and they're still not that positive. It's more complicated. It's more complex. And that example of maybe a Novo Nordisk versus a Siemens is the US versus Europe. There's a simpler investment case on one side of the Atlantic to a more complicated one on the other side of the Atlantic. But that complexity creates the opportunity. One of my best sort of anecdotes to answer this is Italy is renowned for the most complex political backdrop of any country in developed markets.
It is true.
It's been a brilliant source of alpha for our funds over a number of years. Why? Because people panic about the macro and miss what's going on at the micro at individual company levels. That is not a message to go and buy Italian equities. That is a message to go and sniper picking off the companies that are able to operate under those conditions through the different political regimes, but their earnings are growing annually over time. And that is a way to make really good returns. And Europe versus the US is the same example. So that complexity is a real opportunity. What I would say, though, to international investors looking at Europe, and this is mixing the micro that I've just described with the macro in terms of their positioning, is to think of it like this, that if you look at the way European equities trade versus the way US equities trade, they're anti-correlated. They do things differently. What it looks like to me, to us, is if you look at the way the Magnificent Seven trade versus the way that the bond market trades, they're pretty tightly correlated. So when you're building your portfolios of bonds and global equities, which are, or even specifically US equities, that dominated, global is dominated by that US equity piece, then you've got a relatively tightly correlated portfolio. What European equities do is work at different times, and therefore they're a really important constituent piece in your overall allocation. It's not easy for the reasons we've talked about, but it's a really important piece to have a differing part of your portfolio.
Interesting. I haven't think of European equities in that role in a portfolio. I think that's quite new.
And I think it's really, really important because there are challenges to Europe. I wholeheartedly admit the complexity. Brexit, confusing. European elections, confusing. Individual country elections, confusing. Then you've got the policy responses, whether those be monetary policy or fiscal policy and the coordination thereof. You've got defense spending. You've got a war on the border. You've got lots of things that make it difficult to feel a huge amount of confidence to. But on the other side, what I would say is, what are the alternatives? Because the US GDP has been running above trend growth, but it's been funded by an extraordinarily large budget deficit. There's a lot of talk about what the US election result will be. I have no idea whether it'll be Trump or Biden, but actually think about what the difference is. Because I'm not convinced that either side will make a huge difference. I think both sides will probably push for the Trump tax credits or tax cuts to be pushed out further into the future.
That's my point. Exactly. We agree with that. I have talked with so many analysts that they see a different scenario, and I think they will be pretty much the same, actually.
And the point, therefore, is that fiscal deficit continues.
Exactly.
But it's not an impulse anymore. It's a continuation of the status quo. It also means that the overall deficit, the debt to GDP, keeps going up from 100% forecast to 120%. That makes the US, and I know they've got their own currency and it's an amazing currency, but look more like Italy. So my point being, if you start to stress and question some of the fundamentals about where the positioning is so dominant, the alternative to that you need to be doing at a different time and a different condition, which is why this European decorrelated or anti-correlated is quite a compelling argument. Absolutely say you cannot just blindly buy the region. You've got to be buying the individual companies, and that's a function of the complexity. Because certain companies and certain sectors you do not want exposure to. So buying index level equity is taking a different type of risk. You need to be confident in the underlying businesses you're buying.
But that's very difficult. I will say almost impossible for retail investors, because usually get access to European equities, I don't know, through ETF funds or passive funds that just follow the indexes. So if you have to be selective, I mean, you have to start like looking for ETF or funds that are more like case-based.
That's a layup, as they say, for me to answer that question, because I'm an active fund manager.
So, I know.
So you're going to be shocked that my answer to that is, of course you need an active fund manager and not to be doing it through passives. But I think there is a deeper point here. And the reason I've started like that is that people can switch off and say he would say that. But just think about it from this perspective. We've come from a global financial crisis in 2007 to 2009, pick your exact date. But at that period, the world went down a monetary policy regime with fiscal tightening. And what that did was push bond yields from high to zero or even negative in nominal terms in Europe. That pushed up the price of bonds from high to low and yields obviously going to zero in the bond market. What that did in equities was it meant that anything that was bond-like in equities behaved like a bond and therefore went up a lot. And anything that wasn't bond-like in equities got left behind. So you've had this concentration in the marketplace. That concentration leads big companies to get bigger. And if you're left behind, you're left behind. That is an unbelievable backdrop for passive investing. Because you buy an index where everything is the same weight today. Let's say it's got 100 stocks, all at 1%. Half that index doubles. Half that index doesn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Overall, your outcome is really good. And at the end of the year, your passive owns more of the big things and less of the smaller things because it's rebased. And then the same thing happens the next year, and the same thing happens the next year because we've got 10 years of that. So you get this concentration. The winners get bigger. The losers get increasingly smaller in portfolios, and passives win. It's in inverted commas, easy. Now let's think about where policy is going. We've crossed the Rubicon. Fiscal is now part of the vernacular from policy setters, from governments. Populism is incredibly high, even though unemployment is low and productivity is good. And that means that nobody is going to be able to put that fiscal animal or genie back in the lamp. And on that basis, we are not in the same regime we were before. And that means that it's going to be much more important to own the electrification plays because that's where the fiscal impulse is going. Or it's going to be important to own utilities because they've got RAB growth and they have had no RAB growth for the last decade, rather than just buying the winners. And so for me, it's much more important that the active part of the market becomes more relevant again, because it is not just a purely one-directional market driven by monetary and no fiscal that we've become accustomed to between the years 2009 and 2020 with the arrival of COVID, because that was the reason for the fiscal genie to be unleashed.
And also we are in the era of not only fiscal deficits, but industrial policy, for example. That's something that, I mean, I have been doing this for long enough to remember that that was a bad word. And now it's the standard.
I couldn't agree more. And we need to be ready as investors of people's money, as fiduciaries, to protect against something that can be different, rather than to be continuing to invest in the way that has worked. Now, the way that has worked will continue to work if nothing's changed, but it is demonstrably changed. And what we feel pretty passionately about is protecting against that change by owning businesses and having allocations and giving people an option for their portfolio construction that does something differently.
And you mentioned two sectors, and I know we already said that for retail investors is very difficult, but let's say, what are the areas you see more opportunities?
We still see those great opportunities in banks. And the reason for that is not because we think interest rates are going higher, but because we strongly think that interest rates will remain higher for longer. So yes, we'll get cuts in Europe and that will be supportive to the economy. It will be supportive to loan growth, which, by the way, is good for banks because everyone thinks about the NIM, the spread that they make. But volume is also important for banks, and volumes are low at the moment. So some rate cuts, but not back to zero, is conducive to the P&Ls of those banks continuing to do well, capital generation and tangible book value per share growth. What's happened, we think, with banks is they've gone from hugely oversold and unloved and hated to less cheap, but the market's still unwilling to price the sustainability of earnings because they think, or they did think, that rates were going high and then coming straight back down. So that what we think interest rates are going to do is more like Table Mountain, and that means you put those earnings on a higher multiple because they're more durable or more sustainable in terms of earnings. So banks for us still look interesting and attractive. But again, we've got to be wary about exactly which ones. It's not buying the bank index, it's buying individual banks, because which ones are still doing things differently, which ones are making changes, and rather than which ones have done all the heavy lifting and are efficiently priced, so to speak. Utilities, we think utilities are interesting, but again, it's different between power generation and utilities that are the electrification, the networks, because you want that infrastructure story, that CapEx, that RAB growth, as opposed to exposure to the energy commodity, which, you know, who knows where the oil price is going. And so you don't want to be contingent on that macro. You want to be contingent on the thing that you can be sure of, which is the need for electrification and more power and more durability from a European perspective away from Russian gas, which the electrical networks are clearly part of.
So we have banks and utilities.
Well, I could keep going, but in industrials, we think there are pockets of the industrial complex that are quite expensive. But if you look at the upstream of the industrials, which are the materials names, then we think there are some really attractively priced materials businesses. And those are first into the economic cycle and therefore will also be first out of the economic cycle. Another area, which is a subsegment of the whole market that we think is really attractive, is the small and mid-caps. For us, we think that the market understandably sees small and mid-caps as risky. You know, if large caps are the super tanker, the small caps are the speedboats, and speedboats can tip over or hit the rocks quite quickly. We don't think that's true on the medium long term. And if you look at the performance from global or indeed European small mid-caps over multiple years, the performance is excellent. And why is it excellent? Because these businesses have got structural growth. And that structural growth beats the macro conditions over the medium and long term. What I would say is that investors in small mid-caps are far too tactical. They want to buy them on a thematic. They want to buy European small caps because they think Europe's investable, or they want to buy smaller mid-caps because they think the economy is going to ramp, when actually what you should do is make it a strategic allocation. Buy your smaller mid-caps and, as much as you can, forget about them. Own those as your satellite exposure.
That's very difficult when you just forget about them.
But it's about the size of the allocation. And you should allocate a proportion of your overall allocation to the asset class and leave it to do its thing. In the same way, by the way, that people allocate to non-listed assets, whether that be real estate or private equity, where they're willing, in those conditions, to lock up that money for 5 years or more. Well, that's the same mindset that you should be taking with the small mid-cap, but obviously you still have the optionality to redeem at any point that should you so wish or need to. So for us, we think it's a really attractive point, but right here, right now, we think it's incredibly compelling. And why is that? Because Europe is recovering. So tactically, it's an interesting point to invest, but with the mindset of a strategic allocation that you're going to buy and put those in the do not touch category, break glass only in emergency, rather than trade around them. Because I have seen investors in our funds that have done incredibly well over a number of years have managed to lose money by being invested with us in small mid caps, by buying at the top and selling at the bottom and panicking out. So now tactically makes a great opportunity. European small caps are outperforming US small caps, which is compelling. Small caps in Europe are competing well with large caps in Europe, which again is a positive sign. So tactically a great opportunity. Strategically, please try and hold them in that do not break glass in emergency category. So don't trade them.
Oliver, you mentioned already Europe is recovering. So I wanted to finish asking you, are you optimistic about Europe?
The simple answer to that is yes. The reason I'm pausing, there are two answers. Absolute yes, because you can see the green shoots of recovery from the industrial side of the economy, which has been the drag. And we think the consumer can remain resilient. The consumer might suffer because it's coming off a high base, but the savings rates are strong and real incomes are growing, which gives us more of a buffer to that protection that perhaps you don't have in other parts of developed markets. So the consumer, we think, is going to remain resilient. And we've got the industrial production recovery story. So that's why, on an absolute basis, we're positive. We also can see and believe that because that recession piece has been stronger in the industrial side of the European economy, so the deflationary pressure has been greater. And so we're much closer to target inflation in Europe. And that means that we can expect, which is very unusual, Europe to cut potentially before the US. So Europe could cut maybe in June, the US can cut in July or even post-summer. And if that happens, we will start to see the kicker to investment spending and the housing market picking up. Because the ECB data is showing that there is demand for loans, but we haven't yet seen the loan growth. perhaps that first cut will kickstart that side of the economy as well, and that will be compelling. So they're the reasons to be absolute positive. On a relative basis, and then I will be more explicit and say versus the US, I'm really excited. And the reason for that is that I think there are incremental positives coming through in Europe, and you can see that from the Economic Surprise Index. The Economic Surprise Index in Europe is ticking up, versus I think the risk is to the reverse in the US, where the Surprise Index is going down. Europe has had that desynchronized economy. US has had synchronized. So if you start to see a slowdown in the consumer, you don't have that industrial buffer. Europe has already been fiscally prudent. US hasn't. So again, yes, we don't think there's going to be a fiscal stimulus from Europe, but the US, the risk is to the downside that they take some of that fiscal sugar out of the economy. So on a relative basis, even more upbeat. Absolute yes, but relative, even more so. And sorry, the last piece I should mention, because I haven't talked enough about valuation, is that the equity risk premium is 4+% in Europe. What does that mean? That means you are being paid to own, to take the equity risk. In the US, the equity risk premium is effectively zero. And I'm using a simple formula to say what the earnings yield of European stocks is versus the bond yield, the prevailing bond yields. So for me, what you've got to believe in Europe is that the underlying companies are investable and you will make money because you've got an equity risk premium. You're being paid to own them. In the US, to own those when your equity risk premium is zero at the starting point, is you have to believe in rate cuts. And you're taking that macro rate cut decision as the precursor to the returns that you're going to make. That may be the right thing to do, absolutely, but it's a different type of risk. And as I say, if you're 4% equity risk premium in Europe, if we do get those rate cuts that we're expecting, but not huge, but maybe 75, 100 basis points, then all else being the same, your equity risk premium goes to 5%. It will not stay at that level. And that's maybe a 20% return from the 5 to 4%, all else being the same. There are lots of reasons we think the asset class is compelling.
Gracias por acompañarnos en este episodio especial. Quisiera saber qué les pareció. Les voy a dejar una pregunta en las notas del podcast. Por favor, contéstenla. Háganme llegar sus comentarios. También pueden escribirme a mi correo electrónico mveles@df.cl o a través de mis redes sociales, donde me encuentran como Marcela Vélez. No dejen acompañarnos en nuestra programación regular. Primer Click se publica a diario, a primera hora, con los temas que están moviendo ya a los mercados y que van a marcar agenda hacia adelante. Los sábados tenemos una columna en Señal de F, adelantando los temas de la siguiente semana, así que no se la pierdan. Yo los dejo por ahora. Acompáñennos en Primer Click. Hasta la próxima.
Esto fue el podcast Primer Click de Diario Financiero. Lo que debes saber antes de que abra el mercado. Un espacio presentado por EY, construyendo un mejor mundo de negocios.